Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anton Colella. I am the Chief Executive of ICAS. Welcome to our politicians who have joined us today, but also welcome to a considerable cohort of the UK media who've arrived this afternoon. I think I won't say they've been here for the pensions update throughout the day, but they could be very skilled if they have been here throughout the day. So you're all very, very, very welcome today. I suppose in some sense you could say politics comes to ICAS pensions. Not quite as we anticipated when they were planning the conference a long time ago, but you will be aware that ICAS produced a pensions paper coming from our pensions group in ICAS, which has certainly stimulated a lot of debate of recent times. And if I'm not mistaken, it was almost for 2 weeks solid there was commentary throughout the UK media. And if I can just say something before we go into the debate, from an ICAS perspective, we are maintaining a neutral political position here, but we are asking tough questions. And throughout this whole process, we've been engaging with all sides of the debate very actively and neutrally, and we will continue to do so for the remainder of the journey to September 2014. Today is one example of it. We're using a gathering of our tax experts, which was their update day, and we're using this as an opportunity to debate something which really does get to the heart of the matter. I don't think the time I've been in ICAS, and actually for the first in the recent future, that a piece of work that ICAS has produced has stimulated such a response from the man in the street. I think people all of a sudden discovered who ICAS was when they did not know that before, and I think that's the nature of this particular debate. So ladies and gentlemen, let me give you some of the practicalities here. I'm very briefly going to introduce the panel here because you've got the biographies. I don't want to waste any time on that. Then I'm going to begin from my right, going through to my left. They will each have 3 minutes each to set their position and their view on this. Then I'll have some questions, and then I will open this to the floor. If you do have a question, you put your hand up, draw you to my attention. Tell me who you are, and if members of the press want to ask questions, then that is appropriate. Do we have roving microphones, Stephen, here? Okay, well, I will give you this one back, and I will shout loudly to make sure that questions are heard. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're delighted that we have with us Cabinet Secretary John Swinney. John's been very supportive and very open in the debate and been very active in working with ICAS over a considerable time. We're absolutely delighted he's here. Jim Maver, former Scottish Government Minister and CA, ladies and gentlemen, he's one of the family, but he would be taking a political position here on the side of the Yes campaign and is active in the campaign. Greg McClymont, who is a Westminster MP for Cumbernauld, Shadow Pensions Minister, and had the privilege of being one of the few people in this room ever to work for ICAS. He's not a CA. He worked in the storeroom in Rowan House, for any of you that remember Rowan House as a young man, and managed to escape. We're delighted that ICAS has had an influence in his future career, whatever that was. And we're delighted that we have with us Gavin Brown, MSP, from the Conservative Party. So, ladies and gentlemen, without much further ado, John.
Well, thank you very much, Anton, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. First of all, can I say that I very much welcome the contribution that ICAS has made to the debate. The paper that was launched a few weeks ago sets out a range of issues dispassionately to be addressed as part of this debate, and it recognises that many of these issues affect both the actions of the United Kingdom government as well as the actions of the Scottish government in arguing for independence. For our part, I want to make clear at the outset that we pledge to work constructively with the United Kingdom government to resolve the issues that are raised with ICAS, and we agree very much with ICAS on a very important point around those discussions, that it would be preferable and valuable to have early discussions between the two governments on how many of these questions could be resolved. As a point of principle, I believe And this is, I don't think, should be in any way a surprise, that every individual who has contributed to a pension must receive that pension in line with their contractual entitlement. And that irrevocable principle should guide our discussions and will guide our discussions with the United Kingdom Government in the event of a yes vote in the referendum. The Scottish Government is working on a paper on pensions. It will be published shortly, and many of the detailed questions that are raised by ICAS will be addressed in that paper. It's vital that we have a strong and well-founded system to support our pensions. We in Scotland have been successful at providing services and support for older people across a range of different issues, whether it's about pension provision through the public sector or free personal care for the elderly through our local authority systems in Scotland. Last week, the Scottish Government published the report of an expert group on welfare, which showed that the state pension in Scotland is already administered almost entirely in Scotland. We have existing administrative strength to deliver pensions. And it also highlighted that social protection expenditure in Scotland represents a smaller share of Scottish GDP than UK social protection spending represents of UK GDP, which in a sense demonstrates the affordability and financial strength of Scotland in providing for pensions. Our paper will provide a guarantee that all of those currently in receipt of the basic state pension, the additional pension, or due to receive the single tier pension, will receive their pensions as at present in the event of independence, and at the level that they will be at in April 2016. Those in receipt of pensions credit or savings credit will receive those benefits as at present. Future policy decisions by the Government of Independent Scotland will be, as they are at Westminster, for the governments of the day to decide. But in our pensions paper, we will make a number of commitments. One of those commitments will be that the basic state pension and the single tier pension will be updated by the higher of 2.5% earnings or CPI, applying the triple lock. Currently, the UK government has guaranteed the triple lock for the basic state pension only until 2015, and there is no guarantee around the single tier pension. So our paper will enshrine that commitment. The administrative issues around delivery of pensions, I think, are strengthened by the report of the expert group and also by the practice of delivering pensions activities through both the Scottish Public Pensions Agency and also local authority schemes in Scotland. Two final points that I would make. Firstly, a major advantage in handling pensions issues, public, private or state pensions, is the commitment that we have given to maintain sterling as our currency. What follows from that is that the regulatory structure that must govern pensions in Scotland must have a compatibility with the regulatory infrastructure in the rest of the UK, given the fact that we will be operating the same currency. And the Fiscal Commission report that we published in February gave the strength and the evidence around that. And my final point is about the opportunities of independence. Independence gives Scotland the opportunities to create a dynamic economic environment in which we can create and generate wealth within Scotland. That whole approach, that whole focus, is an implicit part, I think, of the arguments for Scottish independence and an opportunity that exists for companies involved in the financial services sector in Scotland and in the provision of the essential pensions infrastructure upon which our citizens depend.
Thank you, John. Jim.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm likewise grateful to ICAS for debating this today and for raising the sensible questions that must be resolved, that can be resolved, especially as they apply as much to the UK as they do to Scotland. And I've got very great confidence that they can be resolved. I have a folk memory of being involved in the arbitration bill in the Scottish Parliament, where there was lots of issues like this, lots of competing voices, and consultation risked offending everyone. And the resolution was getting everybody in the room and having four sessions around this that resolved the previous lack of dialogue, missing empathy, petty rivalries, selfishnesses, potential unintended consequences, things that were plain wrong and things that were of a hobby horse nature. And the net effect of that was when we took that bill then through the Parliament, there was 30 minor technical issues, amendments, and they were all government amendments, etc., and they all passed. But in this case, as with almost any aspect of independence that the UK government is refusing to negotiate, refusing to enter the room, perhaps because it doesn't want to concede the possibility of a yes vote. But it's also a major question for them, because they have to look at this carefully, resolving the issues of the growing inequality gap that David Bell referred to earlier. 1977, the bottom 60% of wage earners in the UK earning 40% of national income. 2012, 32% of national income. Big issue there. Big issue in the overall pension crisis. And big issue when you look at the outlook as presented by Money Week in January, presenting a meltdown of UK PLC. And when you look also at Larry Atkinson's book, Going South, which brutally exposes the weakness that is at the heart of the UK model. Meanwhile, I know that the Scottish Government and this profession of mine can help restore the true role of pensions. I say that as the token pensioner here, but I think, you know, from a pensioner's perspective, we want to see wide help to more people to robustly face a financial future, helping everyone maintain themselves and their dignity in old age. The IOD defined the purpose of pension as being to provide retirement income security for the pensioner, to eliminate the risk that the pensioner outlives his resources. I think the humanity of those purposes is utterly compelling. And part of that humanity brings the need for an honest debate. You know, part of that humanity brings the need for a fair and open resolution with those ends firmly in sight. And the solution, to my mind, is actually pretty straightforward. If we can get all the relevant stakeholders together, if we can restate the common purpose that could unite effort on a fair, open resolution, on a smooth transition, aiming at a robust system that optimises outcomes for all concerned, spell out everyone's legitimate interests, try and prevent people taking positions, list all the issues, systematically address them, negotiate, that means everyone involved in it, and highlight the problems, unintended consequences that might appear, and fix them and keep fixing them. But that means starting that early, that means everyone being in the room. And to that end, today the Institute are playing a really honourable part. And I hope this long-term leads to future dividends, where we can perhaps sell these transition skills to other jurisdictions elsewhere and provide a higher focus, a higher profile for the quality stewardship and skills that are available in pensions here in Scotland and, again, can be sold everywhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Greg.
Thank you very much. Anton, can I just observe, firstly, listen to what Jim said, that in my view, unwinding Scotland from a UK pension system that's been built up over generations and involves lifetime accruals is probably rather different to the arbitration bill in any parliament. It's a much bigger, substantial, more significant and difficult process. And I think this is where we need to get down to detail. And I listened very closely to what John said too. The problem is what John said in his leaked cabinet paper was rather different to what he has said today. Because the fact is that the UK pension system, of which Scotland is part, is built, it's sustainable, and it has a size of population spread which enables risk sharing to Scotland's benefit. I won't need to tell anyone who's a pensions expert here how important being able to pool risk is in the pensions sphere. In John's cabinet paper, specifically where it referred to increased volatility in a separate Scotland, recognised that cardinal fact about the UK system. Now, John's private view in the cabinet paper referred specifically to the state pension, but I can actually think of at least six major aspects of pensions policy in the UK pension system, which if Scotland chose to leave the UK, would see in Scotland potentially increased risks, increased costs, and increased complexity. Now, given the time constraints, I'll just mention three at this stage, Anton. The first, of course, is the regulatory architecture. At the moment, Scottish savers and pensioners benefit from the Financial Compensation Scheme, Financial Conduct Authority, which regulates contract-based pensions, the Pensions Regulator, which regulates trust-based pensions, auto-enrolment, the new system of company workplace pensions for Scots employees, Nest, the government-backed, UK government-backed pension provider for auto-enrolment, and of course the Pension Protection Fund, of which we've heard so much. The risks, costs and complexities to Scotland of unwinding from this system are surely rather significant, as ICAS suggested in its list of excellent questions the other month. Secondly, there's the issue of the EU. The most obvious way in which this has emerged into the pensions debate is, of course, the issue of defined benefit, final salary, cross-border schemes. It's simply a fact that if a scheme operates in more than one jurisdiction, cross-border, it must be fully funded at all times. The current deficit of UK defined benefit final salary schemes in the private sector is around £260 billion. I'll leave the audience, I'm sure questions will emerge on this, that the costs and complexities and the risks of cross-border schemes emerging and proliferating in Scotland if Scotland becomes a cross-border country relative to the remainder UK. A second aspect of the EU debate, which perhaps hasn't had the traction yet that it should have, is the issue of currency risk. Now, John is very clear that Scotland will enter a currency union with the remainder UK. The problem is, as David Bell set out in his excellent presentation, that takes two sides to agree. If Scotland isn't able to agree as a separate country, a sterling union with the UK, then what currency will Scotland use? If, like Dennis Canavan, chair of the Yes campaign, you think Scotland should have a different currency, its own currency, then the pension situation gets very, very messy. John referred to guarantees on pension rights and accruals. What happens if Scotland's pensions are denominated in a different currency? Finally, the state pension. John's cabinet paper also referred to the demographic issue, and it was again referred to by Professor Bell. Scotland faces a very difficult demographic situation. We might call it a triple whammy. Firstly, Scotland is ageing faster than the UK as a whole. Second, Scotland has fewer younger people coming into the workforce. The dependency ratio in Scotland will be, by 2060, much higher than the UK's dependency ratio. And third, and equally importantly, Scots tend to have more years of ill health. So those years of paying into the system are perhaps less than in a UK level. So there's a demographic triple whammy, which the Holyrood Finance Committee, of which Gavin, of course, is a member, considered. I'll say finally, the new UK state pension, which was discussed in the House of Commons last night, will be set at £144 a week. That is built, it is sustainable, and Scotland benefits from the ability across that population spread and size of the UK to pool longevity risk and pool pension risk more widely. Thank you, Anton.